Hello, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us today for another edition of Garden Talk. And with me in the studio is Bob Tomesch, who is a senior lecturer at the UW-Madison and with Extension in Horticulture. And Bob, it's a pleasure to see you once again.
It's always good to be back.
With some hint in the air that maybe spring might possibly arrive.
We're hoping. It seems like a long winter.
You're not going to go beyond that.
No, it's coming. I have that sense. I seen the first flock of sandhill cranes fly in yesterday morning, and so things must be happening.
Excellent. So if you would like to talk about gardening, then the thing to do is to pick up the telephone and give us a call if you're in Madison at 263-1890, and otherwise it's toll-free at 1-800-642-1234, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. Well, one of the things that gardeners love to do is to start seeds, and so what's a general rule for starting vegetable transplant seeds like broccoli and cabbage?
Well, usually it depends on what part of the state that you live in, but you can tend to focus out about 8 weeks to planting time for most things, with the exception of onions, which we should have probably started about 12 weeks out. So if you're looking at the Mother's Day weekend, we should probably be shooting for about the 10th of March for actually starting some of those. So we're right at that phase right now.
Mm-hmm.
If you're in northern part of the state, and you might not be setting things out to Memorial Day, so in that respect, to have our 8 weeks, we'd be looking at the end of March.
And what is the procedure then for starting those seeds?
Well, there's a number of things. For starting indoors, first of all, we need some fairly good medium to start them in, something that's going to be fairly fine. There are plenty of types of medium available at most garden centers, and some of the box stores will carry this. Setting it out in probably a plastic flat, spreading the seeds in rows rather than just sowing over the top. This will help reduce some of the disease problems if you do get started. And then keeping that soil relatively moist. Be aware of where you're setting that flat. Try to keep it away from a cold windowsill or air vent. The cold windowsill will chill down the soil and it'll germinate slower. The air vents from your heating duct in your house will dry out the transplant, so some people sometimes place a pane of glass over that starting flat. After they're started, you can move them after a couple weeks when the first true leaves appear into some of the plastic containers that probably are 2-inch or 4-inch. And transplant those into those types of pots and keep them well watered until you're ready to set those out.
All right, let's go to the phones and start taking some calls. We do have a couple of lines open in case you have a question. It'll be answered fairly quickly. But we'll begin with Martha in Madison. And Martha, what's on your mind today?
Well, I'm going to be having my first garden in many, many decades and first time in Wisconsin. And I would love to attempt melons. Are there certain, particularly cantaloupe, are there certain varieties that are fairly reliable to a novice in Wisconsin?
Well, most of the cantaloupe will, if you look at the days to maturity on the package, you probably want to start something that's going to mature in that 80 to 100-day range. There's probably, you'll have a selection of a couple, three different varieties and some that are earlier and a little bit later. They're fairly easy to grow. You can either start as transplants or sometimes it's just easier to start them directly in your garden bed after the chance of frost has passed. And we're looking at here in the Madison area, maybe around the 20th of May. And after that, it's just a matter of keeping them well weeded, watered, fertilized, and they should produce some fruit for you usually sometime in August. So I look at go to the garden center or some of the catalogs, pick one that's relatively early and one that's somewhat later, and that'll give you a little more production over the growing season.
How much space do they take?
Lots. Each plant, and on the package, it'll tell you how far apart to sow these plants. Many people set them about 3 feet within the row, but by the time they take over the entire area, you probably have a vine that's about 8 feet wide. So
yeah.
Give them plenty of space.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Martha, good luck to you. Thanks very much. The telephone number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. As we talk with Bob Tomesch, and let's go to Whitehall next. And Stephen, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Rose chafers. Question in regards to those little rascals. We had some roses up by the house. They got burned out from the frost many, many years ago, and we lost our chafers. We subsequently put in a bunch of peonies, you know, several thousand feet away from the original area of the rose chafers. However, there's about one rose bush incorporated with the peonies. And the chafers just do devastation to the peonies during their growing cycle. I know that there are some pheromone traps, but what else can we do?
Well, let's step back. Usually we're not. I know there are pheromone traps, but they act as an attractant. And, of course, the rose chafers are not only living in your yard, but they're living on some of the wild roses and other areas in the rough beyond the scope of your yard. So if you place a pheromone trap, what you're doing is encouraging usually males to come into the area. And when they come in, they might not always be caught in the trap, but they are focusing on some of the other plant material that's there. So traps don't always work unless you hang them in your neighbor's yard, as they say. There's some extension bulletins on that. If you Google into the Department of Entomology, and there's one on controlling rose chafers, and it's knowing a little bit about the life cycle of that insect. And if Phil Pelletieri were here, he'd give you
here next Wednesday in case you want to save the question,
too.
Well,
you might want to put that one on the note, and he can get into a little more detail. There are some other options that you might have. I'm not sure if you were asking, is there something beyond the scope of chemical pesticides? Some of it has to do with some of the environmental control procedures that you might do to try to reduce the population. But there are some insecticides that are available for the insect and recommended for rose chafers. If you go into some of the garden centers and kind of look through the lists of pesticides they have, and they'll have some specifically focused for the rose chafer.
Excellent. Thank you,
John. All right, John, thank you very much. We appreciate hearing from you. And we're going next to John in Viroqua. John, go ahead.
Good morning. The last 3 years I've purchased onion sets and planted them, but the bulbs never seem to get real big. And I've planted garlic for numerous years, and you know I plant them in the fall, and they do great. So I was wondering if I should try that with onions to get larger bulbs.
No, that's with onions, many of these set types are probably not quite hardy enough. If we have an open winter, which we part of our winter was, with the exception of the last few weeks, it's kind of hard, and they just won't overwinter. But, and also when they go through that cold chilling period, many times they'll produce a flower stalk, and they will not bulb up either. Here's a couple suggestions. One, with onions, try to plant them as early as possible. If you place them in the soil too late, and we're looking at near the 1st of June, many times that they don't have the quite proper photo period to stimulate larger bulb formation.
Okay.
If you're planting them too deep, this can be a problem because the bulbing structure right where it's beginning to swell needs to have sunlight focused on it in order to stimulate that hormonal response to establish that wide bulb. So planting time would be one issue. The depth that you're setting those bulbs in would be the second one. Also, if you're buying bulblets as opposed to transplants, sometimes if you get the bulblets over a half inch, they're too large and they won't do quite as well.
So would you recommend doing bulblets over the onion sets?
Onion sets will store much better.
Okay. All righty. Well, great. Thank you very much.
All right, John. Thank you very much for your call. Appreciate hearing from you. The number in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 1-800-642-1234. This is Garden Talk. Bob Tomish, a senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at the UW-Madison, is our guest, and we have a couple lines open in case you'd like to get a question answered right away. Rita is next in Eau Claire. Hi, Rita.
Hi, good morning. I spent a good portion of last fall clearing a patch for a new garden, clearing trees, removing roots, removing surface rocks. And I have plans to haul in black dirt in early May. And I'd like to know what else I should do to prep the garden for new planting. Should I have the soil tested, or after the black dirt is hauled in, do I just go ahead and start planting?
Are you in a very sandy site?
I'm not, but I'm in a very rocky site.
Oh, okay.
Soil is actually, I think, pretty good.
Yeah, you can get by without adding soil to the spot. Just remove the rocks, and eventually you're going to find some soil product there. When you do bring in soil, make sure that you're bringing in good quality topsoil, because sometimes even though it's black, it's not the best. Adding organic matter would be a big plus. You can usually go to some of the local or check with your local town, and they store some of the composted leaves and that type of thing. That makes very good compost to add to the soil for your garden. You may have another challenge there. If you just remove some of the brush and trees, etc., some of those root structures that are left in there are going to make their way to the surface, and you're going to have a little bit of a battle this year. So don't be too anxious to get in there and plant. Let some of those come in and then knock them down with a rototiller. If you're placing organic matter on the soil surface, compost, etc., place a couple of inches and then work it into the soil. Do that early on, and then till maybe every week or so, just to kind of knock out some of the weed seeds and some of the trees' roots that are there.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Rita. Thank you very much. Get you ready for the spring gardening season. David in Eau Claire, let's give you a chance. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I live on a high ridge in Buffalo County, and I'd like to put up a raised garden. My land consists of 4 inches of black dirt, 2 feet of clay, and then limestone for about till the center of the earth. Anyway, my wife's got bad knees, so I was thinking of making a garden 4 foot wide by 30 feet long out of railroad ties, maybe 2 feet high. Now, can I just fill that with black dirt, or is drainage going to be a problem? Should I put sand underneath the black dirt, or how would you go about doing that so that you can just sit on the edge and take care of the garden?
Just bringing in regular topsoil is going to work fairly well. Again, adding some compost to it is going to keep it a little fluffier, and it's going to be much easier to work with. That's in any case when we're working with any of the soils. But your idea of raising it that 2 feet works fairly well. Some people will use some of the treated lumbers, 2-inch materials, to establish those raised beds. After that, don't worry. When you do your watering, water sufficiently at one time so the water works its way down into the root systems to a depth of at least 8 or 10 inches, and that'll keep things going for you.
Okay, and there's no concern about using creosoted railroad ties?
Well, the only challenge with creosote is if they're newer ties and they have any secretions of creosote. Some people do develop some skin allergies to it.
Okay.
And so that's why they often will cover that with some cedar boards, a ring around the top, so they have
okay.
something to sit on.
Okay, great. One more quick question. When I get my onions, and how do you store onions so that, you know, in January I still got onions that aren't mush?
Place them in your refrigerator. You can store them in any place that's cool. It just slows down the growth. The only thing is, don't have any apples or fruit in your refrigerator, because that sweet smell that you smell from your apples is actually a growth regulator, and that can stymie the development of your onions.
Thank you very, very much.
Okay, thanks a lot, David. Good luck to you. Bob Tomesch is our guest. He is a senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture with UW-Madison and University Extension. This is Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio with an edition of Garden Talk. We're happy to have you along today as our thoughts turn to gardening. Can't be that far off. And Bob Tomesch is helping us get there by answering your questions about gardening. The number in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll free at 800-642-1234. Bob, are there some garden seeds that somebody can plant in the garden sooner than others?
Definitely. We usually try to divide plants into cool season crops and then some of the warm season crops. Usually our beans and tomatoes and peppers and some of those types of things are usually warm season crops. And they're warm season because they can't tolerate any frost. One frost and you're back to starting over or something like that. But such things as radishes, spinach, many of the cabbages or members of the cabbage family, including kohlrabi, broccoli, and many of those plants can be planted much earlier. They have the ability to tolerate temperatures down into the 20-degree range. Of course, giving a little extra protection on a night that really is going to drop will always help the plant out for the next day.
All right. Back to the phones we go, and to Kari, and she is in River Falls. Hi, Kari.
Hi. See, I was wondering, I wanted to start some flowers in early this year so that they'll be perfect in January or in June. And wondering when I should start, like like petunias and things like that, and should I buy the regular potting mix, or should I start them in the early seed pot things?
You can start them either in the seed pot things or even use a starting mix. One of the challenges you're going to have with petunias is it's a very fine seed, and I would have to look on the package, but I think it takes a good 12 weeks from the time you start those seeds until you set those out. And you're probably looking at Memorial Day or maybe the week before in that area. There are a number of other flowering plants, such as the marigold family and many, many others that you find in the catalog that grow fairly rapidly, and you can get by with that 8-week scenario that I described earlier.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Kari. Thank you very much for your call. And on to Duane in River Falls. Hello, Duane.
Hello. Morning, Jim and Bob.
Good morning.
I'm just starting some seeds inside in peat plugs, the jiffy things. I got some leeks that are up about an inch or three, and the onions are just sprouting. I'm going to do some other things in a couple of weeks. But I'm wondering what type of fertilizer regimen will I need for these?
Usually you can go down to some of the garden centers, and they have some fertilizer mixes for your transplants. And you can even focus on the specific crop that you have, such as onions. Some of the examples, not to promote any specific fertilizer, but Miracle-Gro and some of those types of products have gone very extensive into really focusing on watering transplants. It's a very dilute fertilizer. They usually recommend that application about once a week. But it's very detailed in the not only the package that you get, but many times there's even a little folder that you'll find inside the fertilizing package.
Would you use it full strength in the starter trays as you would for the transplant? Or?
Usually the fertilizer mixture will give you the how to mix it. It comes in a powder, and it'll tell you to dilute it in like a gallon or 5 gallons of water, and that'll be an indication of the strength that they're recommending. And I'd highly recommend adhering to that, because if it says 1 teaspoon in 5 gallons of water and you place 1 teaspoon in 1 gallon, you've just increased the fertilizer salt application by fivefold, and it can be sometimes injurious to the plants.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Good luck to you, Duane. We appreciate hearing from you. Our guest today on Garden Talk is Bob Tomish, and Luba is next in Madison. Hello, Luba.
Good morning. I have a question about endive, and I've planted it in 1 year and wasn't pleased with the flavor, and I wondered if there's a difference in the taste of plants grown from seeds from different companies. And also, if you can pinpoint the type of soil that's necessary to produce a good flavor, what are the other factors?
Well, with endive, it's going to vary between one cultivar and the next, the flavor. The other suggestions as for soil, usually something with a good compost mix in it. If you have a soil test, you're looking at somewhere around 3 to 5%. Organic matter, that will also help. Endive also improves with flavor as we move into the cooler temperatures. And if you're harvesting too early, sometimes that can have an off flavor.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And one last thing, full sun is very important for that plant.
It is. Now,
yeah. You
know, when you want it to be a light green, I mean, that's in the later stages. Once it's fully developed.
Right. And some people will actually do some right at those last stages, the last week or so before harvest. I've heard of people placing some type of canopy or even keeping it dark for a little while. That what happens, there's less chlorophyll and there's other things produced. You might want to try that on a couple of plants.
Mm-hmm. Does that affect the flavor?
It will have a change of flavor. Celery is another example of a plant. Usually they'll wrap the stalk, or if it were a commercial production, they hill soil up around the stalks. And with the lack of light, about 3 weeks, the flavor and the tenderness does improve.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, Luba, thank you very much for your call. Bob Tomish is our guest, a senior lecturer at the UW-Madison in the Department of Horticulture. And let's go to Heidi next in Stevens Point. Hello, Heidi.
Good morning. Good morning. I was calling. I have 3 raised beds, and I planted tomatoes in one of them last year, and they got the wilt. I think it might have been the fusarium wilt. Just wondering if I need to replace that soil to plant tomatoes again.
Yes. In fact, if you have 3 beds, you might want to have some type of rotation where you plant tomatoes in one bed and leave plant some other types of crops in it. Usually the various wilts that we find affiliated with tomatoes remain in the soil up to about 5 years. So you're faced with either having a rotation where you come back to that specific bed about every 5 years, hoping that the disease population is down. The other thing is you can replace the soil, and that would be another way of dealing with it. Keep in mind also that many of these wilts like Verticillium and Fusarium will find spores almost in any soil, and it's the watering condition sometimes that enhances that. You might have too heavy of a soil in that garden bed. Sometimes that'll encourage that. Or in your watering techniques, if you overwater where the soil remains wet too long, and sometimes the diseases have a chance to really get started and going.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for your call. We have some lines open in case you have a question that you would like to get answered about gardening. We'll go to Matt in just a moment, but we do have a line open for you at 263-1890 in Madison, or toll-free at 1-800-642-1234. Let's try Matt in Springbrook. And Matt, what can we do for you today?
Yes. I've been having problems with pepper plants.
Yes.
I end up with real thin-walled peppers if I get them at all. And my plants have a tendency to be getting really tall. Now, I read that it could be too high in nitrogen.
That's right.
And the only thing I really do to them, is I green manure the in between the rows with white clover.
And you're not using any starter fertilizer?
No, just compost.
Okay. Well, a compost from what, rabbits or chicken?
No, it's just lawn clippings and oak leaves.
Okay. It might be too much nitrogen. You're far enough north where one of the other problems you're going to have with peppers is that they're very sensitive to cold temperatures. If we have nights that drop down below 45 degrees, which up in your area is going to happen, it forces the flower buds to blast or die. And peppers are kind of unique in that they'll have a flush of flowers, and they'll go about 3 weeks and have another flush of flowers. And when you hit that flush, if you have those cold nights right during that time, many times the flower buds will fall off, and so you don't have very much productivity.
Okay.
And I'm suspecting that might be part of your problem up there. You might want to look in some of the garden catalogs that specialize in short-season plants or cooler environments.
Right.
That might be a place to try to seek some seed.
The other question about them, I read they like a little bit of an acid soil.
Yes, pH. But pH on peppers can go anywhere from 5.5 up to 6.5, almost 7, and they'll do well.
Okay, but one thing that confuses me is they need calcium, too.
Calcium is something that is transported in the water as it absorbs and is then absorbed through the plant material. If you, in your case, you're fairly sandy up in that area, if the plants really dry out extensively and then you water, and you might want to place your plant, your garden on a 5-day watering schedule where you really water quite well and then give it about 5 days and water it again. Calcium that's in will go into solution and absorb by the plants, but if it gets too dry, the calcium gets up to that flower bud last or the fruit, and so you have what's called cat facing.
Okay.
And I would say it's a watering problem probably more than the lack of calcium.
Okay, because I was confused because I thought, you know, like lime or wood ashes or alkaline, and you'd be lowering, you'd be lowering the pH, right?
Right.
And then that wouldn't be...
Well, wood ashes will usually raise the pH.
Oh, okay.
But sometimes when people place wood ashes and that type of thing on the garden, they place too many. All you need is a fine dusting over the soil and then work it in, not placing an inch or two. I've seen people having a wood stove and they'll put the whole winter supply of ashes on it, and then you're fighting a real battle. It's almost too lye-like or alkaline that's going to kill your seeds or your transplant. So when it comes to fertilizers, you can buy some fertilizers that do have calcium in them, and you might want to consider trying that.
Okay. Well, thanks, guys. You better bring help.
All right. Thanks, Matt. Appreciate hearing from you. And let's go to Mary Lou next in Madison. Mary Lou, what's on your mind today?
Hi. the lady that was interested in the flavor of her garlic, I want to recommend that she go to www.seedsavers.org. They would have about 20 pictures and descriptions of the flavor of just garlic alone. I do it with my tomato plants, and I've gotten some very interesting kinds of tomatoes that I'd never heard of before. It's a nonprofit organization, www.seedsavers.org. And you should see the pictures of garlic that they've got, and they talk about the flavor, too.
Mary Lou, thank you very much. And obviously you're aware of Seed Savers,
yes.
Decorah, Iowa.
Yes, I get materials from them every once in a while. The reason for Seed Savers is they have a lot of heirloom seeds, plants, but they've been around for a long time, and they have a very good collection. In a couple of years, they'll be coming on with old apple tree varieties. I believe they've got the collection from Cornell that was there for many years, and with state monies being reduced, they had to give up something, so I believe Seed Savers took over the old apple orchard cyanwood material.
Bob Tomesch, our guest on Garden Talk, and we're going next to David in DeForest. Hi, David.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Bob.
Hi.
I bought a house just last winter, and there's a planting bed that runs between the garage and the sidewalk going up to the house. It's only about 18 inches wide and probably 20 feet long. The neighbor's pine tree, the white pine, and when I bought the place, there was no plants in it, and the pine needles were just thick in there. So I cleaned them all out, and I planted hostas in there, and they didn't last. They died off right away. And then I tried some alyssum, and they never really did very good either. Is there anything I can do to the soil to help get the pine out of there? It faces north.
Yeah. It faces north. The other thing is, does it get very much sun?
Just a couple hours late in the afternoon.
Yeah, that's not real good for because most plants need at least 6 hours of sun to really do well. There are a few if you want to place flowers, you might want to look at begonias or impatiens and try something like that in that bed. That's probably the best recommendation. The other thing is dig down fairly deep. Sometimes those beds have a hard pan underneath there, and that doesn't help either. But I think your sun is your biggest issue, and if you do go to the impatiens and begonias, you're going to have to water a couple times a week to keep them in pretty good state.
Yeah, I did pretty heavily watering with alyssum, and they just, you know, even the hostas died out. I thought maybe it might be something to do with the soil with the pine needles that were still there.
I don't think the pine needles are doing such a big problem, but you might have a tree that has a lot of roots into that soil bed, and hostas don't compete well with other plant materials.
Okay.
And if they've watered and fertilized, many times the tree roots really proliferate in that area because there's so much nutrient and water, and it's a matter of trying to take care of that problem.
Okay, so begonias and impatiens would be a good thing to start with this year, huh?
Mm-hmm. I would try it. Then, if you look in some of the garden catalogs, they'll have a list of plants for shady areas, but those are two standbys that are pretty tough.
Great. Thank you, Bob.
All right, David. Thank you very much. We appreciate hearing from you. And if you'd like to join the conversation, we have a line open in Madison at 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Off to Lactoflambeau next, and Jim. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I'm calling about the guy who called about building the raised beds with the railroad ties. I can't believe your guest didn't say that. I believe the toxins in creosote are pretty damaging, and he might want to, just for safety's sake, use a liner of some kind to try to keep that from leaching into the bed and then into the, if it's vegetable.
Okay, just to follow up on that, yes, railroad ties, if they have creosote in it, can be damaging the plants, but they have to be a very close proximity. And if they will damage the roots but not the whole plant. The liner is a good idea if you want to go that route. I've used railroad beds in many different situations and observed what's happening there. But usually the old railroad ties, most of the real hazardous creosote will be leached out. The other thing with creosote products, they're not absorbed into the plant material, which many people think. The chemical structure of creosote is so large that it will not be absorbed into the roots.
Joe, thank you very much. Appreciate that caveat. And Grace and Holman, let's give you a chance next. Hi, Grace.
Good Good morning. Thank you for your program.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in Holman, which is close to La Crosse. I believe we're zone 4, probably 4A. I'm not real sure about A or B. I'm interested in planting basil seeds directly into the garden. Do you have a recommendation for a nighttime temperature at which I would be successful at that?
Well, basil's pretty tough.
Oh.
I mean, it grows fairly easily, and people have it reseeding into the garden. Not that it overwinters, but it reseeds, and you'll have it in places you probably don't want it. But I'd go ahead with it. You can purchase transplants and start a few that way, or actually purchase seed and plant.
When the snow is gone, as early.
Well, I would start with possibly. You've got a couple of choices with basil. You can either seed in the garden, but it's going to be quite late. And some people start in starting beds or starting flats and then move the transplants just like you would tomatoes into the garden. Mm-hmm. Again, we're looking at, if you're going to be planting anything in the garden, we're looking at the end of May, even in your area.
Oh, okay. That's what I wanted to know.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
Grace, thank you very much for your call. And let's go next to Tim in Milwaukee. Tim, what's on your mind today?
Good morning. I'm wondering, I've got a compost pile, and I barbecue or charcoal food the traditional way with little charcoal briquettes. And I'm wondering if I can put the spent ashes from those briquettes in the compost without fear of poisoning it, because who knows what they put in these briquette things.
Well, I wouldn't be worried about chemicals so much as I would be worried about just the ashes and the amount that you're putting in. You're going to have such a high concentration there that it's going to kill any bacteria and other microorganisms. So I would take a second thought about even applying the charcoal ashes to that compost pile.
You would, okay. It'd just be too...
It's like adding too much salt to a small area or too much ash to a small area.
It leads
it to a chemical situation which is beyond that pH of, I would guess, 8. And once you get beyond that, it starts killing plant material, and it's going to be around for a while.
Then I will not do it. Thanks so much for your help.
All right, Tim. Good luck to you. Thanks very much for your call. And let's see what's on Don's mind in Gutenberg, Iowa. Hi, Don.
Hi there. Say, I have a problem the last couple of years with my tomatoes. I get blossom end rot, more than half the crop. I've had the soil tested, and the pH is running a little high, 7.7. I wonder if I should acidify that.
Well, it's going to be rather difficult to acidify it, although you can. There should be an extension bulletin on adding, usually they use sulfur, ammonium sulfate or aluminum sulfate,
right. Mm-hmm.
And that reduces the soil pH. I would try to, one thing that you can do is really watch your watering schedule for your tomatoes. Keep it very good watering at least once every 5 to 7 days. And this will allow us enough water so that the water can be carried up into all parts of the tomato plant. It's when there's dryness and not enough water getting up there that leads to some of the cat-facing problems.
Okay, well, thanks a million.
All right, thank you very much, Don. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 1-800-642-1234. And off to Linda in Wachworth, Illinois. Hi, Linda.
I had a question regarding my gardenia.
Mm-hmm.
I have this thing that started on the bud, and now it's not. My gardenia hasn't even flowered, since I bought it. It started with this black thing, like a poppy seed, but it's smaller than that. And then I noticed that I have white stuff all over the leaves now.
Well, you've got some insect problem there. It's usually probably one of many little critters that feed on house plants, and they're feeding so heavily that they're sucking the juices out, and that's where your flower buds aren't opening. It could be mealybugs. It could be some other type of thing. You can take a sample and take it to your local county extension office. They could probably help you out with identification and so that you would know what type of insecticide to come in with. There are some insecticidal soaps that you might want to look at, but you're at a stage of the game where you've probably got such a high population, it's going to take some very rigorous control procedures to get ahead of that.
Oh.
But there, it is an insect problem, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, I thought I can just shower, take it a shower and then soap it.
Well, the insecticide, because we use the term insecticidal soaps, don't mean just adding soap. They found that certain types of soaps have certain preventative characteristics to usually either dry out the insect or dry out the eggs, and so that they do not populate. So just taking that in the shower with you and make sure you're using soap probably isn't going to quite work.
Is that going to work?
No.
Oh, I see. So just by describing it, you won't be able to tell me what...
No, I'm suspecting you've got probably some type of insect. If you look on the undersides of the leaves and you look at it with a microscope, you'll probably find all kinds of little mites and things in there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
All right, Linda.
I have to send it to that university extension here, probably.
Yes, each county has an extension office, and that they could help you out. Or take a leaf sample, place it in a plastic Ziploc so the little critters aren't going to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes some of the garden centers will help you, and they'll even
have... place where I can send it that you may want to, that you can recommend?
Well, you have to go through your extension office in Illinois.
In Illinois, yes.
In Illinois.
Yes.
All right. Okay, thank you.
Okay, Linda, thank you. Good luck to you. And let's go to Woodruff next, and Rose. Rose, what can we do for you?
Hi. I have another question in regards to ashes.
Uh-huh.
I have acidic soil. So would ashes help do some neutralizing of that?
It will. There is an extension bulletin on wood ashes, and if you do a search, it'll tell you about the amount, how much to place on so many square feet. And I'd really encourage you to read that so you don't overdo the problem. I've seen way too many cases where people apply too much concentration of wood ashes, and then they can't grow anything. And I've even seen in perennial flower beds where it's killed some of the perennial flowers. So, yes, you can apply some wood ashes, but it's a very small amount, and it'll give you recommendations per square feet.
Okay. Great, thanks.
All right, thank you very much, Rose. Good luck to you. Bob Tomisch is our guest on Garden Talk. He's a senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison and University Extension. I'm Jim Packard. Keisha Mibra is our phone answerer today, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along on Garden Talk today. Bob Tomisch is our guest. We have a couple lines open. If you have a question, in Madison, the number is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 1-800-642-1234. I have some tulip bulbs that I bought last fall, Bob. Can I still plant them this spring? Or?
Well, it depends where you stored them for the winter. Some people have had luck where if they placed them in a refrigerator, and of course if they stored fruit in there like apples, it can have an impact on the viability of those tulips. Set them out and see if they'll still grow. The tulips that are on the market now have been stored in a refrigerator someplace in a very controlled environment, so it can be done. Set the plants out when you can in the spring, or at least the bulbs, and if they grow, fine. They may not flower, because sometimes that flower bud that's already there for this season was initiated and was there, but possibly has dried out.
Mm-hmm.
But the leaf tissue that does grow will replenish that new bulb that's being developed in that area, and you'll have some flowers for the following year. So place them in the ground and hope.
All right. Kirsten in Ironwood, Michigan is next. Hi, Kirsten.
Hi. I have a question about horse manure as compost. Last summer, I planted a couple trees, and up where we live on a gravel pit mixed with clay, and having horses, I mixed in with some garden soil, some horse manure, thinking it would kind of lighten up the soil and be good for the tree, and when I told a couple people about what I'd done, they said, oh, horse manure is horrible to be used as compost because it contains a lot of weeds and a few other reasons, and I was just wondering if it's true or not, and if it is a good compost material to use.
Well, it's a good compost material if you allow it to compost for a year or two.
Okay.
It does break down. They were right about the weeds because the horse's digestive system isn't quite that complete, and some of the weed seeds that you'll find in your grasses, that in the hay that you fed, will pass through the animal and you may have a problem. Usually the people, if you want to compost it, they suggest having a hot compost pile, which has fairly high temperatures. getting up into that 140-degree plus range. Oh. And so it's a proper way of building a compost pile that will help you reduce the seed population.
Okay. So they were right.
Well, not completely. Horse manure does make a good compost if you make it properly.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Kirsten, thank you very much for your call. And on to Joe in Wausau. Joe, what's on your mind today?
Hello. My radishes and rutabaga always have little maggot holes in the roots, and I just can't seem to prevent that. Is there something I could do?
There's a few things you can do. The maggot is the result of an insect laying the eggs just as the plants emerge in the soil. You might want to try planting as early as you can. And I believe, phenology-wise, when the lilacs are in bloom is when the adult insects are very active in laying eggs, and so some people do not plant any coal crops during that period. There are some insecticidal soaps that can be used for the product, mixing them and then watering that row. This will keep the adults from laying eggs in that area. Light dusting of wood ashes over that row right when you plant and then following up after any rainfall until they get started will keep also the adults from, or at least reduce the adults from laying eggs in that area, so you have much better quality plants. A little sideline, some of the early settlers, after they burned a brush pile, would usually rake away the wood ashes and then plant their radishes and some of the and onions in that area just to get away from having that problem with insects.
What's the name of the insecticide? What's a good name?
Well, it would be products that are soil type insecticides.
Drenches,
yes. And you have to again read the label on the product, and it'll tell you whether or not you can use it for vegetables. And sometimes there's a waiting period. In other words, you can't use the vegetable possibly for 10 days after you applied the product. So you have to follow that recommendation as well on the label.
I was thinking of maybe using a floating row cover.
That will help, definitely. There's some Remay products out there.
Uh-huh.
People that are growing organically do rely on Remay products. The secret there is to place it over that soil as soon as you plant so that as the new plantlets emerge from the soil, the insect is not there laying eggs.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks very much. And again, for people who say, what was that, a floating row cover?
Floating row cover. What it is, it's kind of like a fine mesh, usually white. You can see through it like a muslin material. It has very small holes in it, so light does penetrate through it. They use it for insect control on broccoli and cauliflower and many other things. So this is a very good product. We're seeing more of that available. You can find that at the garden centers.
Do you have to stake that down to keep it from blowing away?
Oh, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Some people, when they place it over the row, what they do is dig a small trench around the area where they place that and then cover that with soil so that the wind doesn't blow it away. There's different techniques where you can place hoops in the area to raise the Remay above the soil so that the plants aren't damaged. I've had cases where we tried it at one of the research stations, and this is probably 20 years ago, and we had a bad wind and it was over broccoli, and the Remay beat away till it worked a hole.
There wasn't anything left of the broccoli.
It came through, but it can be a problem, so we suggested staking. But it's a good idea. It's kind of a new innovative idea for controlling insects.
Bob Tomesch, our guest. Vicki's next in the UP. Hi, Vicki.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm planning on planting my first vegetable garden, and I was just wondering when the best time would be to start my plants indoors.
Well, what part of the UP are you in?
I'm in Gugavik County.
Okay.
So I'm pretty on the far west end.
Okay, I know about where you are. You're probably looking at probably the 1st of June for setting out the plants. Don't be overly anxious because the frost will knock you back.
Right.
But so back up 8 weeks, and we're looking at probably around the 1st of April starting your tomatoes and some of those plants.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Good luck, Vicki. Thanks very much for the call. The number in Madison is 263-1890 and otherwise toll free at 800-642-1234. And OJ is next in Egg Harbor. Hello, OJ.
Hello, how are you today?
Very good, thank you.
Great. I got a little hint for all you people out there who have got indoor plants.
Go ahead.
Years ago, I used to service plants in nursing homes and hospitals and restaurants. And because people were very sensitive to bug spray and things like that that you wanted to use on the plants, came up with an idea that I think really works and I think might help a lot of people out there. You take a flea collar, a dog or cat flea collar,
mm-hmm.
and hang it on the plant, preferably towards the base where the bugs are coming up from the bottom. And it works.
Well, I can't substantiate that because I haven't tried it. The other thing is I'd be a little bit concerned about making sure that it's the product, the chemical that's in the flea collar is approved for use around plants. There are some regulations on that.
Well, I don't know if it was approved or not, but all I know is that I used it on my indoor plants and on IVs, and I couldn't use any kind of sprays in the businesses that I was going into, so I... you know, relied on the flea collar.
I suspect many of the flea collars have a pyrethrum-type product in there, and insects can sense that chemical, and so they leave the area.
Pardon?
I said many times if there's a pyrethrum-type product, and those are in some insecticides that are sold for vegetable control, the insects can detect that chemical, and so they do not come into that area. So that
right.
might be what's happening.
Right, exactly.
Uh-huh.
So I really didn't know what was in it that was working, but I figured if it worked on the cats and the dogs, it might just work on the plants. And fortunately, it did. So I just thought I would call in and share that with your audience.
All right, OJ. Thank you very much. You've been very helpful. And let's go to Robert in Oak Creek. Hello, Robert.
Hi. I've got a problem with the ashes. I probably have damaged quite a bit of my garden, but I've got about 3 rows of Norway pine, maybe about 65 or 75 trees in all. Can I put ashes around those without doing any great amount of harm?
You'll be doing harm. Sorry to tell you that, but just because they're that large, they can probably tolerate a little bit more because they have deeper roots. But usually with the wood ashes, that's any high application amount can be hazardous to any plant material.
Well, what would be a good thing to do to get rid of my wood ashes?
Well, usually there's a plan in place if you check with your local extension office as to possibly places that do collect the wood ash product.
Yep.
Some people will send them to where they actually use larger composting if they've placed them in a landfill, things like that. There are some suggestions for that.
In other words, putting them in the disposable landfill is
what they suggest, yeah. And there's some regulations there because somebody tosses some in that were a little hot, and then pretty soon you've got a garbage truck running down the road with a little smoke coming out of it. So there's a whole issue on how to properly put those together.
Well, I guess I can get away with doing that because I've got cold ashes and paper bags there by piled up, ready to dispose of.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much.
All right, Robert. Good luck to you. Thanks very much for the call. And on to Nancy in Milwaukee next. Nancy, what can we do for you?
I just wanted to tell the story of my mother and father planting tomatoes for the first time. I brought over the tomato plants. They put them in the ground. And as I went to visit every week, the tomatoes were growing just furiously. They had tons of tomatoes on these 6 plants. Neighbors would come to look. Neighbors took away tomatoes. It was just remarkable. I asked my father if he had done anything special to the soil, and he said that he had used what an Indian had told him a long time ago. I doubted this, but let it go. He said what he had done was to put a dead fish in the ground at the base where he would plant each tomato plant. I wonder if the dead fish really had any effect on these plants, but they were remarkable and covered with tomatoes. What do you think of that?
It works. They sell fish emulsions as in byproducts of fish where they butcher fish, the heads and all that. They make
uh-huh.
fish emulsions, and they use that as a fertilizer. Very high nitrogen fertilizer along with some other nutrients in it. It does work. You have to make sure you plant it or do it deep enough. I've heard people that have used fish or fish emulsions, and everything from the neighborhood cat to every skunk and possum in the
yeah.
neighborhood are in there trying to find it, and often, more times than not, dig out the plants that you've planted. But it does work.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. And we're going to continue to talk about gardening questions as we roll along with Garden Talk. Our guest today is Bob Tomesch, a senior lecturer at the UW-Madison and in Extension Horticulture. Is there a website that people can go to get more information about the Extension Bulletins?
Well, Extension Bulletins, yes, we have a website at CE Commerce. And you might have that website, but it lists all the Extension Bulletins that we have available. If you go to the pathology department, we have some fact sheets there on specific diseases. And similarly, the entomology department has some 1- and 2-page fact sheets on specific subjects, like the person that had the Rose Schaefer problem. I'm sure Phil's got something on that. So with this electronic world we live in, there's a lot of materials that are available to us just through the computer. Go down to your local county extension office in your county, wherever it happens to be, and they can also access that material for you.
We're going to continue with Bob Tomesch after we look at the latest news. A reminder that on Garden Talk next Friday, Bruce Allison, Madison area professional arborist, will be our guest. And on March 23rd, it's lawn and turf expert John Steyer, associate professor in the Department of Horticulture at the UW-Madison and also with University Extension. I'm Jim Packard, and Keisha Mabra is our phone producer today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us on this edition of Garden Talk. We have been talking and will continue to talk with Bob Tomesch, senior lecturer at the UW-Madison and University Extension. Bob, a pleasure to have you with us today.
It's always good to be back.
And we've been looking ahead to spring and talking about gardening, and it really makes me feel like the season could be upon us.
Yep, people are getting anxious. They see a little spot of bare ground. They walk over there. It's still frozen, but they're hoping for a chance to do something fairly soon. And probably in a couple of weeks, we can start doing some yard cleaning. And
one thing I was going to ask you is that I had received some email from people in northwestern Wisconsin, the greater Eau Claire area, that remarked about the lack of snow cover last year and then pretty much most of this year. What's the situation for gardening in that part of the state?
Well, the gardening isn't the challenge. It's those perennials that we have in that area. And I was up in that area a couple of weeks ago, and once you got beyond Black River Falls, there was hardly any snow at all. At the Spooner Research Station, for example, no snow. Soil temperatures got down to 17 degrees, and normally when we have snow cover, we're looking at soil temperatures close to 30, 28 or so. Once we get below 21 degrees, we start having root kill of our perennials, and so those that have herbaceous perennials like mums and some things like that will probably see those damaged if they haven't mulched them, and that's why we're encouraging people to mulch their perennials. Same thing with trees. Some of the more tender, if you happen to have a fruit tree like a sweet cherry or some grape varieties, they just probably will not leaf out, or they'll leaf out very late because the upper roots have been killed. The lower roots may have survived, and then it'll start pumping the water up into the tree, and they'll get it going, but they'll be later at leafing out. I've seen that definitely on grape varieties.
Okay. Let's go back to the telephones. The number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 1-800-642-1234. And Sharon is next in Racine. Sharon, what can we do for you today?
Planting a cherry tree this spring. When should I do it? And what should I be cautious of?
What kind of cherry tree were you looking at?
It's not a Bing sweet cherry. I got it in Door County. It's a sour cherry.
Right, probably a Montmorency.
Probably.
Okay. If you can plant that as soon as it warms up, the tree will leaf out unless you've got it started indoors. Some people sometimes do that. And then you have to wait until you plant your tomato plants because the leaves that are on it will often be damaged by frost. But setting the tree in a very sunny area, they need full sun. We're probably looking at 5 years until you start receiving fruit from that tree. And you might even want to consider having a second tree of some variety there, a cherry tree, so that you have ample pollination.
Is that important to have that second tree for pollination? Necessary, I guess?
Not so much for the sour cherries, although it's a good idea.
Okay.
And you're looking at possibly a different cultivar other than Montmorency. So if you know what the cultivar is, you can have the second one. There are certain trees that Like, for example, we need apple pollen for apples, but two apples of the same variety will not pollinate. So if you have, well, if there were two apples, two Macintosh, they will not receive pollen from each other. But with apples, don't worry about it. We have so many flowering crabs in the neighborhoods now, and that provides us all kinds of pollen.
When should I dig this up now?
You're going to move it from up there to down to your area?
I'm going to move it from Racine to northern Illinois, about 30 miles south, to
okay.
a friend.
As soon as the ground thaws out,
okay.
move the plant before it starts budding out at all. You've got until buds swell to do anything, so you've got about a three-week window. And once things thaw out, dig it, move it down, get it back in the ground, water it generously for the first 3-4 weeks, and you'd be 90% on the road.
Okay, so mainly water generously, that's what I have to make sure to do.
Right. And, in fact, don't let the roots dry out when you do dig it. I'm not sure if you're taking a soil ball. If you can even move it bare root if it isn't that big. But then take some moist newspaper, shred it up, throw it around the leaves in a plastic bag, and that'll keep it moist till you get it down to your planting site.
All right, great.
All right, Sharon.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for your call. We appreciate hearing from you. And Barbara's next in Milwaukee. Barbara, what's on your mind?
Hello.
Hi.
Last fall, I dug 32 holes facing east and south of the property, and in each hole, I put two daffodils, two tulips, and an iris. What do you think's going to come up?
Probably all of them, if the squirrels haven't beat you to it.
I've been watching, and they're deep. I put them 6 to 8 inches deep.
The only plant is the iris. That one you need to plant right at the soil surface. That rhizome structure almost needs to see the light of day.
Oh, then I might have lost the iris in there.
Well, I'll tell you what you do. The iris leaf is going to be a little bit broader than some of the others.
Uh-huh.
And when you see him come out, kind of slowly work him out of the planting that you've done and put him in a real-life situation.
Oh.
So you might, I mean, you'll be able to tell the iris leaf. It's usually fairly narrow, and it'll send up that leaf even if it's planted too deep. But then you can work that little iris out and then move him to where you want him.
Okay. And when do you think, at the end of the season, should I divide him or should I leave him alone for a year?
Once you get the irises out of there, move them to a regular spot. The tulips and the daffodils, just leave them where they are. They don't really need to be redug maybe every 5 years or something if they look like they're getting too thick.
Very good. We'll save the iris in spring.
Good luck to you, Barbara.
Thank you.
Appreciate hearing from you. The number in Madison is 263-1890, and otherwise it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Mary in Madison is next. Mary, what can we do for you?
Hello. I discovered that I have some gardening products that have been left out all winter, such as a bottle of fish emulsion and a little neem oil sprayer. And I wondered if that product is still going to be viable in the spring, having been frozen and thawed.
They haven't?
They have or haven't?
They have. They've been outside all winter.
Okay. Well, the fish emulsion will still work for you.
Okay.
That's a fertilizer product. The neem oil, that has a relatively short life, and you might want to start over with that.
Okay. How about a Roundup?
Ooh. When we get to chemicals like Roundup and some of those products, if they freeze and thaw, they kind of change their chemical structure, and they're not as potent as they were.
Mm-hmm.
You might want to try mixing up a small batch and nailing the first few weeds you see come up in the spring and see if it's still viable.
See what happens.
Yep.
All right.
And they should go down in probably 3-4 days, start
mm-hmm.
wilting.
And may I ask another question?
Yes.
I have a source from a greenhouse, big suppliers. I have a source of peat moss that comes from the bulbs that have been packed for spring planting. Has that peat moss, do you think, been treated with fungicide and other things, or could I just collect that and put it in my compost or around my plants?
My guess is if they had bulbs in there, the bulbs were pre-treated with some type of fungicide to
mm-hmm.
keep them from rotting.
Mm-hmm.
The fungicide product, of course, is approved for plant material, and so you may want to work it into some compost, but you use that compost around your shrubs and trees and that type of thing, just as a safety precaution. Okay. Because the tulip bulbs aren't an edible product, and so there's different fungicides you can use for that. It's probably a fungicide that they used, and that is available for protection of non-edible plants, woody plant materials, and so what you're doing is reapplying it to another target area.
So I wouldn't put it in with anything that I'd use to eat.
Right. I would try to be on that safe side.
Okay.
All right, Mary. Thanks very much for your call. And on to Dick in Lake Villa, Illinois. Hi, Dick.
Yeah, I heard one time on this program a way to sterilize soil, but I can't for the life of me remember what it was.
Well, it all depends on the volume. Sterilizing comes in two ways. One is heat treatment and getting that temperature above usually 130 degrees, and you can do that in the oven, cook it like a cake, but you want to leave the house because the odor is going to be a little strong. They do pasteurize soil where they use steam heat and, in a sealed container, and that's often done commercially, so you've got a couple of options there.
Put it in an oven at 130, huh?
Well, it's got to get up to 130 on the inside to kill off the organisms that are there. Usually you can turn the oven at maybe 150 or 160 and cook the soil that way. Usually they've done that years ago before we had a lot of starting soil mixes. They would sterilize their garden soil or whatever they use for some of the starting transplants and do that in the oven.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right, Dick. Thanks very much. We appreciate your call. And Bill is next in Dubuque. Bill, what can we do for you?
Hi. Can you hear me all right?
We can.
Okay. I have two questions. One's pretty quick. I want to had rabbit problems. I had rabbit problems with three trees, and I want to run a runner, you know, from down below the damage to up above where the damage was ringed around the tree. What is the best time to do that? What type of time of the year to do that?
Okay, have they girdled all the way around the tree?
Yeah, they did a good job.
Well, join the crowd. I found two trees that way in my yard this year.
But the snow was so deep, they were
right.
Really starving.
And they did the damage in the last 3 weeks because I was watching all winter long and it hadn't happened.
Right.
And people that have apple trees or fruit trees, I would suggest getting out there if they haven't got any tree guards around them. And this year they reached over the tree guards and did damage.
Right.
Okay, you're talking about in-arching. If you one thing you might want to do a little reading on doing that. There are some bulletins on in-arching. It's a type of grafting. You can take water sprouts. Those are those shoots, the one-year-old shoots that are growing on the tree, probably coming off the trunk, and you normally cut those off and throw them away anyway. And the time to do that is as soon as the it gets warm enough here, probably around the first part of April, when the ground thaws, because that's when sap will be flowing. We'll have plenty of water going up the tree because that travels in the wood. It's the sugars that are made in the leaf tissue that sends downward that we want to get down to the root system. And when the bark's gone, that can't happen. So you do that in-arching. You slide it under the bark, above the wound, and down below the wound.
Right.
And then as a last resort, I'd take plenty of these pruning compound sprays and spraying that on there. Sometimes if they didn't girdle it extensively enough, there's some cambial cell that's left there, and I've seen cases where the cambial zone will regenerate some new bark, and eventually that'll help the healing process.
Is that compound spray like a wax?
It's like a black tar.
Okay.
But you can buy it at most garden centers and hardware stores, and it says pruning compound.
There's no way to feed the roots the sugar another way?
No.
Okay. The other question is, I have an instrument that measures the amount of water in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering, I grow melons. I don't know what percent to use. What percent is optimum? Is there a place I can find it? Because this instrument, if I let soil go bone dry, I get a zero reading.
Right.
And if I drench the pot until it can't hold any more water, I get 100%. So I figure around 50 would be good for melons to keep it even.
You might want a little higher than that. I'm not sure. I don't know what those numbers are. You might want to look. There's a growing vegetable book by Knox, KN.
I tried that. I was at the library, and that doesn't tell.
Okay. Sorry, I can't give you an answer on that.
Okay.
If you look maybe on the internet on hydrometers, it's actually called a tensiometer, and they might give you some figures there.
on the internet on those instruments. Huh?
Yeah, tense,
I've got it written down.
Yep.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right,
much.
Bill, good luck to you. Thanks very much, and appreciate hearing from you. Let's go to Toma and Nick. And, Nick, what's on your mind?
Hey, guys, I'm wondering, I got a lot of old garden books, and I read in there about how beneficial lake weeds are as a fertilizer. What do you know about that?
They're a great source. Lake weeds do very well because usually the lake water has a fair amount of phosphorus, potassium in it, and so you're adding fertilizers right along with the lake weeds. Lake weeds are probably 90-some percent water anyway.
Right.
And so, and they decompose very fast, and so they do make a very good compost.
Okay, great. I got an unlimited supply. Also, what do you guys know about those upside-down tomato planters?
Yeah.
I don't want to say the name of them, but you know what I'm talking about?
It's just a technique. All they're doing, and the plant will tend to want to grow upward afterwards anyway.
Oh, it
so
will.
So it's just kind of a gimmick of selling a product. One last thing on your lake weeds, you can even use that as a mulch between the rows, and then they'll kind of dry and be crusting control weeds, and then you just, in the fall, spade it back into the soil.
Yeah, that's what I've been doing the last couple of years, but I was just wondering how beneficial it was.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
Okay. Great.
All right, Nick, thanks very much.
Guys.
Appreciate your call. 263-1890 is the number in Madison. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. And let's go to Menominee next and to Fred. And Fred, what's on your mind today?
Good day. I want to know what type of cherry trees can I grow in this area?
Well, you're kind of in the northern part. There are a couple varieties. North Star and Meteor are two that I believe were developed by the University of Minnesota. And those two varieties are usually available in many of the nursery catalogs. Those you can almost count on. They tolerate zone 4, and I've even had them at up in the Ashland area survive. Of course, it's a little bit warmer as you get next to the lake. But I'd take a look at those two varieties. You might want to try Montmorency. I know there's a grower south of you as you get over towards the St. Croix River that has a few of those and has had fruit on them regularly. But I would go with North Star or Meteor.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, good luck, Fred. And maybe you can come back and give us a progress report after you get that planted. Dolores is next in Kenosha. Hi, Dolores.
Oh, good afternoon. I have a clematis, and it's the Jack Manny, and it had belonged to my mother, and when she sold her house, I got it. And it comes up every year, but it's not doing well here. Well, I have a sister who has a perfect spot. She has trouble with other plants, but she does the clematis in her yard. She has a gorgeous group of them. I want to give it to her. And I've heard you transplant it in the spring, but I want to do the best for it and for my sister.
Yep. In the spring, as soon as the soil thaws, dig out a generous soil ball around that. Move it. First year, it'll kind of be stunted many times a little bit because they don't transplant that well, depending on how kind and what kind of care you give it. But it should move for you. You might want to think of dividing it, splitting it in half, and giving half to two, one to you and one to your sister.
Mm-hmm.
It could be where you have your plant, if it's become shadier and maybe it's not doing as well in that deep shade.
It's full sun, but I think where it is, it's on the line next to the fence, which it grows on, but it's getting competition from grass
and probably,
and it's not in a big area.
And probably trees have grown roots into that zone, and they don't compete well with the woody plant materials.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. Dolores, thanks very much for the call. And let's see what's on Carol's mind in Waukesha. Good afternoon, Carol.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
Good. We have about 40 trees on our property, pine trees. And little by little, they're starting to die off. They brown. The needles start browning from the bottom and start, you know, going towards the top. And then we lose them. Do you have any suggestions why that's happening or what we can use?
Yeah. What kind of evergreen do you have? Are they spruce? Or?
I'm not real sure.
Are they kind of very...
The longer needles?
Oh, they are longer needled?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's a whole host of fungal diseases, and that might be one possibility. There's also some moth. What you might want to do is take a picture of the dead and dying.
Okay.
And take it down to your local extension office, and they can probably give and take some of the needles mm-hmm. that are still alive on the tree, but just starting to at the dying point.
Okay.
And they can help you out there. Unfortunately, we're dealing with those types of trees when they there aren't too many pesticides that we can use.
Mm-hmm.
Some things that you can do is try to thin out the tree so they're not rubbing against each other and shading each other. And those types of moisture environments tend to encourage the disease problem.
Okay, would the white soft flies, are they, would those have anything to do with it? Because I know we had quite a few of the I think they're soft flies.
Usually they eat on the needles from the previous year.
Okay.
And so, and after a number of years, they can cause problems. But what you're describing to me, I'm guessing, is a disease.
Okay.
And and knowing the type of plant would be very helpful
mm-hmm.
because then there are some control procedures that you might be able to try.
We have a guy come that come and put weed killer on our grass.
Yeah.
Would that have anything?
I don't know.
We really wouldn't. Okay. All right. So I'll take a picture, take some needles, and take it to the extension then.
Right.
All right, thank
okay,
you.
Okay, good luck, Carol. Thanks very much. Appreciate your call. And Dominic, let's give you a chance here in Madison. Dominic, go ahead.
Yes, hi. Just have a two-part question, actually. One, well, to give a little background. A number of years ago, I moved into a suburban woodlot in just outside of Madison. It is primarily, it's 1 acre, primarily oak, some elm, some cherry, and some box elder. The oaks are having some trouble. I'd like to help them along. My thought is that they seem to be getting crowded out by particularly the box elder as well as the cherry. I don't think it is the oak wilt, since it's not as sudden, but it seems to be just a slow decline from one branch to another. So I just wanted your thoughts on that and what that other things I might be looking for. The second part of the question is... now that the canopy is opening up a little bit, just trying to figure out what I want to put in for an understory. There's a big mess right now, and I'm just trying to clear some stuff out and get some things that might be a little more, self-sustaining, not only for, more attractive in terms of being able to get out there and not get pricked. A lot of thorns and seems like wild raspberries.
And gooseberries, probably.
Yeah, it's a mess.
With your oak, it may be oak wilt. Some of those decline very slowly. I would encourage you to call an arborist and have them come out. They can take a sample and verify whether or not you have that problem and then come out with some suggestions as to what you might want to do. Your idea of replenishing the understory with some other diverse type trees, there are some that do fairly well in the shade and eventually will grow and look fairly well. You might want to look at the maples and some of the basswood or linden. That might be another suggestion. So there's a list of growing or trees suggested for Wisconsin. It's another extension bulletin, and there it will list some trees, and you can try to match the soil that you have there with those that will grow best in those areas.
All right. All right, that sounds good. Thank you very much, sir.
All right, Dominic, thank you very much. I'm sorry we can't get to more calls, but we have run out of time, and our guest has been Bob Tomesch, senior lecturer at the Horticulture Department at the UW-Madison and University Extension. Bob, it's a pleasure always to see you, and we'll look forward to a return visit.
We'll be back. Spring's coming, and so will I.
Very good. And next week on Garden Talk, we'll be conversing with Bruce Allison, Madison area professional arborist. And on the 23rd of March, John Steyer, lawn and turf expert in the Department of Horticulture at the UW-Madison, will be our guest. Monday at 11, Gary Knowles, Madison travel writer, will showcase some of the nominees for Wisconsin's Wonders. And then at 11:45 on Monday, financial advisor Frank Armstrong, the author of The Informed Investor, has some advice on strategic investing. Our thanks to Keisha Mabra for on-air phone production today. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.